report published today by the Ombudsman for Children's Office titled Plan for Places. The report on forward planning for the provision of school places for children with special educational needs. The Ombudsman has said the state is failing children with special educational needs. The report concluded when children are not included within the mainstream school system, it constitutes discrimination. Children and their parents unable to secure school places, absolutely unacceptable, says most people. Dr. Niall Muldoon is the Ombudsman for Children and he joins me this afternoon. Good afternoon, Niall.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
What impact does a report like this have on Ireland's education system and the government department?
Well, I suppose what we really want to do is hope that this report will lead to the increase in capacity around schools for children with special education needs. We spent the last year working with the Department of Education and the NCSE figuring out what they do and how they plan and how they forecast for these places. And we still find that despite increased capacity for forecasting, better information and improved resources, improved spending in regards to special education in general, we still find ourselves in a situation where many children are left without a place or certainty of a place in September for primary or post-primary school. So that in Dublin alone, there's 130 children at this moment in time, not sure if they're going to be going into secondary school or primary school.
And can I just ask you about that, Niall? The black spots are noted as Dublin and Cork. Is that due to population size?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the growth has been biggest in the urban setting, so that's something that wouldn't be unusual. But we've found issues in Kilkenny and Clare and Athlone. So it's not just the major centres. But again, the concept here is that we're trying to push to create a society or an education system that is totally inclusive of all the children in Ireland. That means we need to push for capacity throughout the country, and that takes forward planning. And what we found is that while there's forecasting, there's not enough action that follows it up with the planning. And that's what we're pushing for. We need, from our point of view, it's been a dereliction of protection of the child's rights in this situation. And it leaves the children really devastated, and their families are working so hard to try and find a place when they don't have to do that for their brother and sister who doesn't have special education needs.
You mentioned, you know, spots like Dublin, Cork, Athlone also. If we look around our local area with Kildare, we know our population is growing. Census 2022 will definitely state that. Well, you can never say definite, can you? But I think we can all assume that. House prices here are growing. We know our population has grown. So that obviously means also children with special educational needs are having a difficult time in this county too.
That's very likely, yeah. I mean, I think it's across the board. There has been improvements. It's not as widespread a problem as it has been before. But again, it's, from my point of view, it's really disheartening and frustrating to see a situation where one of the case studies we have is a young boy called Aaron, who himself and his seven classmates went through primary school together. And at this moment in time, still aren't sure they're going to secondary school in September. And the mother's had to fight tooth and nail to get everything that she's got. So you've had 8 years to plan for this and it hasn't been provided yet. So we really need to push the government to start increasing the capacity locally, and we need leadership. From our point of view, we want leadership from government, we need it from the ministers, the civil servants, and also from patrons and boards of management who, up to date, some have opted out of providing special education needs, and that's something we think needs to change.
Yeah, you have noted in this report that the Department of Education should prioritise the publication of a plan to ensure there are enough spaces. What does that mean, to prioritise the publication of a plan? Because I was speaking to somebody else earlier in regards to, you know, government hopefully doing things, and, you know, plans can be put in place, and unfortunately things like bills, etc., can be stalled, and stalled for many, many years.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when we're talking plans, we need an action plan that needs to come with it. There needs to be an investment that goes alongside the plan. You know, we've situations in which we created new legislation in 2018 that allowed the government to insist on schools taking a child as they need it. That happened in the Dublin 15 area. The minister served that notice on 39 schools, and I think eventually only 20 schools took children in, and we're still short of spaces. So what's happening is that we're forecasting, but we're not putting in the money and the resources to back it up, and that needs to happen. The two things can't happen separately, they have to happen hand in hand. So the schools in the local area are provided with the skills, the resources and the physical space to provide for the child in that local area. At this moment in time in Dublin alone, we're spending €72,000 a day transporting children out of the community to some other community to be educated. So when
that's
they come
a huge
home,
amount of money.
They have no friendship groups, they have no people who know them, they don't understand each other,
right.
And there's no play dates. So there's a real gap in the concept of inclusive education.
Yeah, the report also urges the department to mandate schools to build or repurpose appropriate existing accommodation to meet the needs of these children in the short term. What would that actually mean?
Well, again, a simple situation. There's parts of Dublin where maybe one school has 32% or 33% of their students would have special education needs. And within a 5-kilometre radius, there could be 6 other schools that have no children with special education needs. You know, so again, with those schools, if those schools are not taking anybody, it means the children will have to be bussed out and moved to some other community, which in turn blocks the spaces for the children in that community. So if we get everybody to take the load and spread the load and allow all schools to be upgraded to provide for children with special education needs, then those children get to grow up in the community right from the start, from the day they're born. They're part of an inclusion model which shows that we value you from the start and we're going to help you grow up with your brothers, your sisters, your neighbours, and you create a friendship group that lasts forever.
Approximately 15,500 children currently have to travel outside of the school catchment area every day. You just noted in terms of Dublin, €72,000 is spent. It's not acceptable. Again, in the report, it says that another 1,455 students, they are in receipt of home tuition, and that's as a result of the specialised places. But it has been noted that home tuition should only be for a short-term period because it really doesn't benefit the child.
Yeah, I mean, from our point of view, the home tuition is a good concept, but it should only be a stopgap. I've likened it to our emergency department. You want to be fully healthy, you want to be looked after properly in the health system, and if you go to an emergency department, you should be there only when it's a crisis and for the shortest period of time. Home tuition should be like that. It should be a situation where perhaps your family have moved from one area to another in the middle of a school year, and you may not get a place till the following September. That's home tuition. But it's not a substitution for quality, inclusive education. And I'm afraid 1,500 students using home tuition is a difficulty from our point of view. They're not getting the full access to the rights that they deserve.
Niall, this might be very specific, but we do know there has been an increase in the number of families becoming homeless in this country, meaning, you know, they have to move around, and some of those families will have children with special educational needs. Mm-hmm. They are going to be probably the most impacted by a situation like that.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And again, that's why if we can move, we as a state have signed up to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Person with Disability, which promotes an inclusive education system. And the best way for an inclusive education system to work is to mean that every school can cater for any child with whatever their needs are. And that's what we need to get to, that concept that wherever you move to, we can cater for you and there's capacity. And that's something we need to work on, and particularly those children who are moving around like that. It's really, really difficult. And the education is one of the things that anchors them and provides them with security and certainty. So we need to be able to facilitate that as much as possible.
To let our listeners know, one of the parents gave testimony and they described how finding a school place is like having an additional part-time job. You can only imagine the stress on these people's shoulders. Approximately 25% of students in Ireland are estimated to have special educational needs. That will come as a surprise to many people listening now.
Yeah, I mean, again, listen, it's a broad term in that regard. You're looking at, you know, anything from dyslexia or dyspraxia or sort of areas of difficulty reading or language issues. So that's a range of issues. But in the more, more severe or serious issues, maybe 4% of our student population are in special schools, 3% are in special classes, and about another 1 or 2% are in mainstream classes with special supports. So we estimated during the COVID pandemic that probably about 22,000 children are in that sort of a range. But yeah, there's a lot of children who have special education needs in the broader sense.
There are some positives to take out of this, Niall. The report did note that the number of special classes in Ireland, or the state, has increased almost fivefold. That's in the past decade. And adding capacity in the schools to support children with special educational needs provision was a priority of the National Development Plan. So we can take that as a positive. But seeing such a massive increase and knowing there's so much more room to fill, I guess, is the wording I could use, is kind of a scary thought, I guess.
Yeah, but I think, and I give good credit to the government over the last 10 years, the state has really stepped up and made huge changes and huge improvements, and that's to be applauded. But we were coming from a very low base, Ciara. Mm. You know, we had really not looked after our children with special education needs. In fact, it took a High Court case back about 20 years ago from the Senate case to recognise the rights of a child with special education needs to be provided with education. So we've been playing catch-up since then. So I think we're well on our way, and I think what this is doing is trying to push that every decision we make and every solution we come up with from here on in has to be inclusive in its broader sense. So we can't just start building new separate schools away from everybody else. The children are moved from one community to another. We need to start thinking about how do we provide the education that they have a right to within their own community and provide for those children ahead of time. So those mothers that you talked about, it shouldn't be a part-time job. It should be as smooth as it is for their other children. You know, most parents don't think too hard about it. You go to the school in the local area, you go on then to the secondary school in the local area, and the job's easy. You have enough things on your plate, but when you have special education needs, you have to fight for every single step of the way, and that's not fair.
Look, thank you so much for the time. I know you're very busy today. That is the Ombudsman for Children, Dr. Niall Muldoon. That report is published today by the office. It's titled Plan for Places, the report on forward planning for the provision of school places for children with special educational needs. And if anybody out there listening wants to get more information on that report, the full report is available on oco.ie. Dr. Niall Muldoon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ciara.
Kildare's KFM.
Now, Ireland has hit its recycling targets for the 24th consecutive year. This is a new report from non-profit Repack. The report showed how Repack achieved an overall recycling rate of 66% and recovery rate of 96%. That surpasses the European Union target set at 65% for recycling and 75% for recovery. I'm now joined by that chief executive of Repack, at Seamus Clancy. Hello to you, Seamus.
Hello, good afternoon, Ciara. Nice to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you too. So
a great guy you done just before that, Niall Muldoon. Highly supportive of him.
Yeah, he's a really, really
amazing
lovely
guy.
Really lovely guy. Very serious report there, obviously, we're speaking about earlier, Seamus. And of course, we'll pass on those well wishes. It's always nice to get well wishes, isn't it? I mentioned there the European Union targets. So 65% for recycling. We were 66%. Recovery rate should be 75%. That's the target for the EU. Our recovery rate is 96%. A lot of people won't understand what recovery rate does mean. I only found it out myself a little earlier. What does it mean?
What it means is it's a measuring criteria that you have right across the European Union of everything that's collected, that's recycled, and then the balance of that is used as an energy recovery. We call it residual derived fuel or solid residual fuel, and that's used in cement kilns and incinerators to generate power. So I suppose no better time than we have serious fuel issues that we're up at that level. 96% is really up there at the top of the league in European terms. It means that we, out of the total of 1.1 million tonnes of packaging on the market, we collected, recovered and recycled 96% of all packaging, which is a testament really to the waste management system we have in the country, from your green bin outside your door in terms of your dry recyclables to the actual what's done in business as well and how that's collected there.
Seamus, 2020 obviously was the year the pandemic was declared, masks, you know, different things like that to do with, rubbish and recycling in general. 2021, what did Repack, I guess, expect? Because the recycling and recovery of 1,020,580 tonnes of packaging material did happen last year, and Repack surpassed the 1 million mark for the third time. Were you surprised that 2021 was such a successful year in that sense?
No, I expected. I think the whole education and understanding of consumers at large and businesses has moved to another level. Climate and climate action is to the fore of everybody's mind, and it's talked about around the dinner table, it's talked about around the board table of where it should be. So I think that social consciousness is out there right across the sphere.
Would it be fair also, Seamus, to note that people probably had more time to, and forgive me for using the word care, because I know people care about our planet and our environment, but had more time to care about everything they were doing exactly right, I guess, when it comes to recycling, because people's lives are so busy, especially pre-pandemic. You know, you're going here, there and everywhere. You might be spending 2 hours, if you're a person who lives here in County Kildare, in traffic each day, even more so, you know, getting up and back from the city centre. And you could be forgiven that your mind isn't, you know, completely focused on getting your recycling right.
Well, maybe those few hours is no longer stuck in traffic. You are at home working from home, and it gives you a bit more time to think of what's in your surroundings, what I need to do a little bit better. And definitely we saw that coming through in terms of what was happening. For instance, you see glass there at 86%. That's phenomenal. You know, how many people actually thought more about going to the bottle bank, making sure that trips to the supermarket, they did that. How many more people thought about, you look, the impact of online convenience that arrives at your door, sometimes way overly heavily packaged. You actually do make that extra effort, I think, when you see, and there is this sort of moral obligation on you, I think, to say, oh, let's do a little bit better here on that. And we are doing very well across all the materials, including plastic, which is a target of 22.5. We're at 31. However, the big challenge is within the plastic sphere, where we've got to really reduce as much as possible that we're using and recycle a lot more. And I think a big change in that last year was the introduction, which we Repack works to the fore on, of getting soft plastics introduced into the dry recyclable bin. Maybe something your listeners may not be aware of, though, is that of the 1,100,000 tons of plastic or of packaging on the market, roughly 50% of that is generated at the back door of businesses. And that is the one area that we really have to up our game on.
Okay.
Those that understand the actual value of recycling of the materials and the value of that resource are actually doing it. But unfortunately, we have a very large cohort yet of businesses that do not adopt really good recycling practices.
So by and large, Seamus, you know, the average person is doing their job. They're doing what they need to do. You know, the key materials surpassed the EU recycling targets. It's definitely a positive story for us. Glass, as you mentioned, 86% in Ireland. The EU target was 60%. So over 26% there. Metal, 71% was recycled here in the country. The EU target is 50%. Again, in the 20s, the percentage how much we have gone above and beyond. Paper, 84%. The EU target is 60%. Plastic, as you referred to, we recycle 31%. The target for the European Union, 22.5%. And wood, 69% was recycled. And the EU target there is 15%. So a massive difference in that. So it's nice to hear a positive news story every now and then, Seamus.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think we can't stop there. The EU targets are going to change in 2025, and plastic is the one that's going to be brought from 22.5% up to 50%. So it requires the producers to really look at the packaging they're placing on all products. You're going to a supermarket today, and all of a sudden you're seeing a change, a big change, from when we saw, say, for instance, apples wrapped in plastic in a tray. We're now seeing that movement to getting rid of all the plastics and putting it in for protection, for safety reasons, putting it into cardboard or paper. That's because there's been two fundamental policy platforms that have been introduced at Europe. One is the circular economy package and the other is the single-use plastics directive. And both those together now require all producers to pay fees based on the recyclability of the packaging they place on the market. And I'll give you an example. For instance, for plastics, and we determine the cost of what it does for every single item, Repack today charge €117 a tonne for recyclable plastics. But for difficult or non-recyclable plastics in this country, it's over €300 a tonne from next year. That's called eco-fee modulation, so it's a financial instrument
okay.
to bring about behavioural change.
Okay, Seamus,
and
we're
it's already working.
Well, we're just stuck for time here, but thank you so much for joining me. You are, of course, Chief Executive with Repac, and Ireland has yet again hit its recycling targets for the 24th year in a row. A report in the Irish Independent in the past few days has noted that the state is spending more than €250,000 a year. That's on a private clinic for fertility treatment for cancer patients. Since 2014, the Sims IVF Group has made €1.3 million. That's from the HSE for oncofertility preservation treatments. The figures have been released to the Irish Independent. This is following a FOI Freedom of Information request. And I am joined this afternoon by Paul Murphy, People Before Profit TD for Dublin Southwest. Thank you for joining me, Paul.
Thanks for having me on.
So people who are diagnosed with cancer may wish, obviously, to freeze their eggs or their sperm to protect their fertility. That's from any damage that could possibly happen due to treatments such as radiotherapy and chemotherapy. And Ireland does not yet, the paper here notes, properly regulate or provide fertility treatment through the public health service. So €260,000 a year is going to private fertility clinic for cancer patients. One can understand why they need to do that, but what is your take on the situation, Paul?
Yeah, so the first thing I'd say is, of course, it is a good thing that cancer patients are provided with fertility treatments and the ability to freeze eggs, etc. That is a good thing. But the fact that it is being done by private clinics, paid for by the public at a cost of over €250,000 a year, highlights two problems. One is this privatisation in reality of our health service. This is one example of it. But there are others, like the National Treatment Purchase Fund, effectively operates by, once you're on the list for long enough in the public system, they go and pay private and to keep the whole private system going. And the second is the absence of appropriate fertility treatment, IVF in particular, within the public health system. It does not make sense that this is done on a for-profit basis. It should be provided for as part of the public health system, which would mean then that the state doesn't have to go and do deals with private clinics who are operating on the basis of maximising their profits.
Now, the HSE does fund fertility preservation treatments for cancer patients. That's through the Rotunda IVF Clinic, and it was bought by Rotunda IVF Clinic, was bought by Sims IVF Group in 2014. What do we do as a government and as a public to change?
We simply need to provide, as is the norm in the vast majority of European countries, to provide these services within the public health system. So then the state wouldn't have to conclude these contracts with for-profit providers.
But how do we do that? What does that mean for us? Why aren't we doing it currently? What does it mean in terms of financial implications? Will it take money away from other areas of the public health service that we know are desperately needed right now? We know the waiting lists are continuing to increase, especially since COVID-19 and the pandemic was declared. Just how can this actually happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the starting point is to say that we should not be rationing access to fertility treatment according to wealth or income. And I think the vast majority of people would agree with that. Some people shouldn't get, because they have money, you get to have a higher chance of having a kid. This is in circumstances where people don't have cancer, just in, you know, in the kind of the regular case of someone looking to freeze eggs or IVF or whatever. Then we need to fund it. Obviously, in this case, it will be cheaper to do it insourced within the public health system than it would be to outsource, because you're not paying for the profit of this company. But we would need to employ the staff, bring the specialities into the public health system. And that could be done on a phased basis, which, for example, can start as saying that, for example, cancer patients are the first ones to get it while we're building up our capacities in the public health system. But as part of a modern, secular, non-religious influenced health service that we should be building, we need to quite quickly get to a point whereby, like in Scotland, for example, and in most European countries, couples, you know, who don't have cancer are able to access these treatments.
Now, in 2017, the government did approve the Assisted Human Reproduction Bill, and it would seek to make fertility treatment part of the health service. But since then, the bill has stalled. You were obviously a TD since 2014, I believe, Paul. So the stalling of that bill, what's the issue there? 2017, you know, 3 years before the pandemic, we can't note anything to do with the pandemic in terms of that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this has been repeatedly promised It's part of Sláinte Care. There's a reference to it in the programme for government. In 2016, Leo Varadkar promised public funding for IVF. And the funding hasn't been forthcoming, basically. It's an issue of money, fundamentally. There's two aspects to it. I mean, there are.
If I just ask you one question, Paul, in terms of it's an issue of money, can you understand how a government could find difficulty in finding a balance in where to put public money for public health services when the services in general are already run? Can you understand, as an opposition TD, how it could be quite difficult to, I guess, implement that?
Well, it's a question of political choices. I mean, Ireland is the fifth richest country in the world on a GDP per capita basis. But the issue is, if you want to operate as a corporate tax haven, and if you want to pay massive pay increases we're seeing today to very senior public servants on more than 150,000 euros, well, then that has consequences. I mean, what they're announcing today in terms of pay increases for people who are already on 150,000 euros of 10,000 plus is going to cost 60 million euros. That's about three times the amount that it would take to have a fully rolled out, free for, you know, everybody, part of the public health system, fertility treatment. And, you know, we're in favour of different choices being made. There is, I mean, the legislation that was recently passed will regulate to some extent the currently unregulated kind of Wild West environment of private fertility care. But that isn't enough. It has to be provided as part of the public system to give people and mean that people can access it.
You touched on it earlier. Ireland is currently the only country in the EU not to offer publicly funded IVF service. And earlier in 2022, Ireland was ranked 40 out of 43 countries in Europe for fertility treatment. Thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. That is Paul Murphy, People Before Profit TD for Dublin Southwest. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much.
Now, in the UK, investigations are underway. This is following the discovery of polio. This is a virus which hasn't been contracted in Britain since the mid-80s. The UK Health Secretary, the UK Health Security Agency says it's likely there's been some spread between closely linked individuals in East London. It was detected during routine tests at a sewage plant. The virus, which in rare cases causes paralysis, has been mostly eradicated worldwide due to vaccines. And I have seen a good bit of conversation about it on Twitter over the past hour. Sky News are asking the question, what is polio? Have people in the UK been vaccinated against it? And what's the risk to the public? So a quick little debrief of what they've written here. They say that the risk to the general public remains low. I don't know if you remember before the pandemic was declared, you know, it was all about, you know, what stage we were at in the different countries, what stage they were at in terms of the risk the virus at the time was giving. So polio in the UK, low. It's a contagious virus. Polio. It can be transmitted through coughs and sneezes, also through food, water, or objects that have been in contact with the feces of someone infected with it. It can live in an infected person's throat and intestines for weeks. They can spread it without experiencing any symptoms themselves. The virus has been eradicated in most parts of the world due to a successful global vaccination program, but it is still found in Afghanistan, Nigeria, and Pakistan. The last case of wild polio is how it's worded here. was contracted in the UK was confirmed in 1984. Janie Mackers. And the UK was declared polio free in 2003. So symptoms, you can experience mild flu-like symptoms such as high temperature, extreme tiredness, headaches, vomiting, stiff neck, muscle pain. They usually last up to 10 days. The question's asked, am I vaccinated against it? This is in terms of Britain. The polio vaccine is part of the UK's routine childhood vaccine schedule. I believe also over here in the Republic. I will iron that out in a moment, though. So most people in London, where the traces have been found, are protected. A chief nurse for the NHS in London said the majority of Londoners are fully protected against polio and won't need to take any further action. But the NHS will begin reaching out to parents of children aged under 5 in London who are not up to date with their polio vaccinations, to invite them to get protected. And I also am assuming that parents of children who never got their children vaccinated against certain viruses like polio, are they at risk? Is that potentially why the virus is spreading more now? I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. Anyway, we're going to move on to a different topic now. The government today have published draft alcohol labelling regulations. We're going to go through that with the Head of Communications and Advocacy with Alcohol Action Ireland. Hello to you, Una McKinney.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for joining me and listening to that about polio. Sorry, I don't want to be scaring anybody. I'm just bringing them.
I think you're right. The 4-in-1 vaccination does have polio in it.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
I
never like to say these things without double checking.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm pretty sure. But Eunan, you are obviously, as we said, working with Alcohol Action Ireland. And today that publication did come of the draft alcohol labelling regulations. So do go into this a little bit more. It's under Section 12 of the Public Health Alcohol Act of 2018.
Yeah, it's one of the many. There's about three or four measures of the Act, the 2018 Act, outstanding to be implemented. And one of the kind of cornerstones that remains to be implemented is the provision of health warnings and information on alcohol products, which at the moment there's no obligation under alcohol producers to place any such warnings or any such information on products. In fact, they're exempt from such obligations that would normally apply in other foods products. So what the government have done yesterday evening was that they submitted to the European Commission the draft regulations which outline how these health warnings, which were enacted in the legislation that was passed in 2018, how they would be actually implemented onto the products and indeed into places where there would be no product information available, like we say in a pub, for example. You know, it's not that you're going to get a glass that states what the warning of the alcohol is, but there will be a document in a premises which would state, and a poster which would state what the risk is. So what these the basic warnings are is that there's a risk to your health from alcohol, that there's a risk to your pregnancy from alcohol, and that there's a direct link between alcohol and fatal cancers.
Yes.
And they're the three warnings that will have to appear now on products when these regulations, which, as I say, have gone to the EU, they have to be further scrutinised by the EU and the members before they can be implemented.
Yeah, so the first one, the direct quote, is drinking alcohol causes liver disease. That will be one of the warnings. The second notes that it needs to display a health symbol intended to inform the public of the danger of alcohol consumption when pregnant. And then the third, again, a direct quote, there is a direct link between alcohol and fatal cancers. We look at the packaging on cigarettes and how that has changed over the past probably 20, 25 years. I can't really ever remember personally the packaging not being there, but it did have a great impact on many people. But you also hear, Eunan, some smokers saying, look, I know how bad it is, but I'm addicted. Those photos, unfortunately, aren't going to turn me off.
Correct, and that is absolutely the case. And so the warnings have, over the last 20 years, as you say, have consistently developed. And so they started out very mildly with just a warning in a typeface saying what the warning was. But then in the last decade, they would have moved into graphic images, and they would have moved now into more recently into plain packaging on tobacco. And so all of those measures over the last 20 years have essentially helped bring about a situation whereby, we'll say, certainly a generation ago, over 40% of people smoked, to a situation today where 17% or 16% of the population smoke. And so these are contributing factors to informing people clearly of what the risk is. Now, of course, at the level of where someone is highly addicted to a highly addictive substance like tobacco, there are undoubtedly people who will say, well, this makes no impact to me because I'm addicted to the product. And of course, that is the case. And indeed, you could draw a similar analogy with alcohol in some respects. But what the endeavour of the Public Health Alcohol Act is to bring about a series of measures, introduce a series of measures which will stimulate a situation amongst the whole of population, the drinking population, to make them better aware, better informed, less available or less shall we say, susceptible to the marketing of alcohol, so that we bring about a situation where we reduce alcohol use. And so this is part of that process. You know, we demand, governments demand of citizens that they behave in a particular way and act in a particular way. And in fact, the industry talk about all the time about acting responsibly, yet the industry never informs the citizen or the consumer of the risk. And so what this does, and what this will do when eventually it does end up on the packages, is that it'll clear that up, and it'll make it absolutely clear for people in a very conspicuous way that there is an absolute risk to your health when you consume alcohol.
Look, I really appreciate you taking the time this afternoon. That is the Head of Communications and Advocacy with Alcohol Action Ireland, Eunan McKinney. Take care, Eunan. And just to finally note on that topic, in addition, the regulations will now make it mandatory that alcohol and calorie content within the product is also stated, and that the Public Health Alcohol Information website, which is called askaboutalcohol.ie, is displayed. So there are the new government publications of the draft alcohol labelling regulations. I was noting there just before I was speaking with Eunan that in the UK investigations are underway. That's following the discovery of polio, a virus which hasn't been contracted in Britain since 1984, has been investigated, I guess. What am I trying to say? God only knows. Anyway, we're speaking about over there, you know, in Britain, they do receive the polio vaccine. And Michael, as always, you're on the ball. Thank you so much. He says, hi, Ciara. The polio vaccine is given to infants in the 6-in-1 and the booster at about 5 years in the 4-in-1 vaccine. So that probably makes sense over in the UK why they're saying to certain parents who their children around 5 years of age haven't gotten the full 4-in-1 vaccines yet. He notes, sadly, the three countries which are Afghanistan, Pakistan, obviously neighbours there, and Nigeria are, he notes, relatively high levels of polio due to local distrust of the vaccine and the motives of the health services delivering them. In some places, immunisation teams have faced violence and some have been killed. That comes in from Michael and Kling. Thank you so much. You're always educating me so much, Michael. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for listening. Anybody else wants to get in touch? 0833 97 97 97. The findings that I'm going to be speaking about here are included in the latest report, which was compiled by the Inspectorate of the Department of Education. And it has revealed that post-primary school students have said that mask wearing and physical or social distancing during the pandemic have stopped them building the trust with their teachers needed, which it notes here, for them to report bullying. I am joined now by Kiki Martiri. She is Director of Spun Out. How are you?
Great. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for joining me. So it's key, I guess, in any issue, if there is potential bullying or alleged bullying, that students feel like they can speak to their guardians in the school place. But unfortunately, this is just another impact the pandemic has had on students.
Listen, I'm disappointed but not surprised to hear about, you know, continued effects that we're feeling and aftershocks from COVID. It makes sense that through teachers, you know, wearing masks or being remote or distance, that young people have a decreased sense of intimacy and trust and safety with them. And I think the only way through it is to name what's going on. You know, the more that schools and teachers are given this information and say, hey, this is another effect that some studies have pointed to say, hey, I know you might not feel like as close to me as maybe you did in teachers what that you had when you were in person. And that's something that a lot of people are feeling right now. But I want to say, even if you don't feel like you know me as well, that you can still come to me and there's this way to reach me and I'll be after school at this time, or you can come talk to me in private, you know, in the classroom in these particular hours. And just communicating, I know it sounds basic, but just if we can all feel connected in this shared experience that students are having when it comes to feeling that really important trust level with their teachers.
So these revelations are included in the latest report, which was compiled, as I said, by the Inspectorate of the Department of Education. And it did the report or the findings of student focus groups. They were held in February and March of this year. It was compiling the students' views on preventing and tackling bullying. It took place in a sample of 5 schools and included input from 100 primary pupils and 120 post-primary students, which is obviously secondary school. So cyberbullying, that was one of the main issues for for both primary and post-primary students. A person being deliberately isolated or excluded, also a key issue for post-primary students. If we start with isolation there, Kiki, what advice would you have for parents who feel their children or guardians are being isolated? And what advice would you also have for the students when they're in that position?
Yeah, absolutely. The good news about the report, there is good news within it, is that young people are a lot more savvy online than older generations are. They know how, a lot of them know how to report things online, they know how to recognize cyberbullying, and they know it's wrong. And the in-person stuff can be a little bit more confusing sometimes. So for parents, trust that your young people actually do know their online spaces even better than you do, and try to have an open, non-judgmental dialogue with them that is filled with trust, and say, hey, I get that maybe I'm, you know, your mom or your dad maybe isn't the first person you want to talk to about this, but do you have anyone in your life? Do you have a friend that you could talk to? Do you have a teacher at school? Do you want us to help you maybe talk to someone that you could trust, like a counselor or a cousin or anyone else that you can open up about this? Even if it's not us, we just want you to have a safe space to talk. And I think that can go a long way, and even getting them to open up to their parents. And for young people, and I also want to talk to, you know, teachers and administrators, getting creative about how people can build trust and start these conversations is really key. If someone is being bullied or isolated at school or online, they might not have that trust level with a school counselor or a teacher, and that's okay. But if they have one other pupil, one other peer that they can talk to and share that with, and then maybe ask that friend to go to a teacher and talk to them about it in confidence, that can really help lessen nerves. So getting creative, maybe it's writing a letter and leaving it for your teacher, you know, after school and having that be an option. Not everyone feels comfortable with those hard face-to-face talks right now.
And of course, people can reach out to Spun Out, which you are director of. It is an Irish non-governmental organisation. It's focused on providing online youth information, and people can contact the organisation. Kiki, give out those details, please.
Yes, if anyone would like to talk to someone right now about how they're feeling, or any of the information is prompted questions, or you need support, you can text Spun Out, SPUNOUT, to 50808 for free, 24/7, for our free tech support line. And as well, like you said, you can visit spunout.ie for more information and support.
Thank you so much to Kiki Martiri, the director of Spun Out, for joining me this afternoon. And just to give out the other details, Kiki did note the free text line, Spun Out, was what you text to 50808. And you can send a mail to hello, H-E-L-L-O, at spunout.ie, and also phone 01675 3554. Keith has been in touch over in Cheshire. Hello, how are you? And he says, hi to the people in Leakslip. I'm not even going to try and pronounce Leakslip, Osquelga there, Keith. I don't know how to do it. And he says, Ciara, great to hear your show. Always interesting subjects. You're so kind to text me in. Thank you so much for listening, Keith. We hope you're well over in Cheshire. And enjoying listening to the home sound of KFM, a Leakslip man.